From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Francisco? Order of Milpitas.
San Jose.
Coming up, we'll continue our series on the redevelopment of the Hunters Point Shipyard. Today, the significance of jobs.
So are you creating the kinds of jobs that will help lift this community out of poverty? Our concern is you're not.
Then we'll hear about some of the country's first women to get college degrees and what they decided to do with them.
When they got together, they began to look at what was going on in San Francisco and how they could make a difference. They were catalysts for change.
And we'll tour a 150-year-old school for girls that embraces the future.
Our youngest girls at Hamline walk into their science classroom and they put on a lab coat because they need to imagine themselves as a person who can program robots.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. Beginning in the 1940s, the naval shipyard at San Francisco's Hunters Point was the destination of a huge migration. Many of those new arrivals were African Americans from the segregated South who came for the plentiful work opportunities on the San Francisco waterfront. But when the shipyard closed down in 1974, thousands lost their jobs. That led to high levels of unemployment, and coupled with the crack epidemic and increasing gang activity, the area became much different from what it had been, more depressed, more dangerous. But in the 1990s came a glimmer of hope, a major redevelopment of the former naval base. It was delayed for years, but now the long-awaited project is well underway, slated to bring new housing and business to the neighborhood. It brings promises for the community, including the one that drew people here in the first place, employment. Today, KALW's Daphne Matsiaraki continues her series on what some people are now calling the San Francisco Shipyard.
Freddie Carter is working on Block 51. This is one of the first buildings that will come on the market.
Right now, we're putting in all of our foundations for the columns and all of the base foundation, and then we'll begin to do the shotcrete of the exterior walls around the perimeter of the building.
Carter is overseeing construction.
I'm hired by Robert Zobayashi. Robert Zobayashi is being hired by Lennar.
Lennar is a development company reinventing the shipyard, building 12,000 housing units in a multi-billion dollar project here in the Bayview.
I am from the Bayview. I live right in the 94124.
And that's important because according to the Community Benefit Agreement, or CBA, signed by Lennar in the city, people who live in zip code 92124, like Carter, get first dibs on the redevelopment jobs. And according to the CBA, 50% of the employees should be from San Francisco.
So for every one person for the company, you hire one neighborhood resident.
Melinda Galrosa is also from the neighborhood. She's a carpenter working with Carter.
I'm excited because I'm working.
She says it's not just a job. It's a union job and pays well.
Everybody has to price the same labor rates through the union.
Danny Cook is executive vice president with Lennar Urban.
And obviously the expectation of top quality construction as a consequence of using union labor.
To help meet a contract with the city to hire local unionized workers, Lennar is paying nearly $9 million to a workforce development fund. That's very important in an economically depressed part of the city like Bayview Hunters Point.
I think that for years, this community was ignored for a number of reasons.
Shaman Walter is executive director of the Young Community Developers.
And we just ended up being isolated, disenfranchised, and missing out on the economic growth.
Bayview Hunters Point has the highest level of unemployment of any district in San Francisco. Since 2000, the rate has mostly fluctuated between 14 and 22%. Walter says after the shipyard shut down, the community has suffered from lack of investment and fundamentals from grocery stores to education.
In terms of the school system, there's lack of equality in terms of what's available for our families in terms of school choices. You know, so that plays a role into everything.
The Young Community Developers and another job training program called City Build are both almost completely funded by the developer. Walter says it's made some difference.
We've placed in the past month about 5 individuals directly into the shipyard and actually paid their union dues so that they can get into the union and get placed on the job site.
That's good for those 5, but the numbers are a bit of a reality check. According to the city, the redevelopment project in the shipyard is predicted to create 2,000 construction jobs annually. However, records show since last July when construction began in the shipyard, only 465 people have been working there. Less than a third of them, 155, come from San Francisco, and only 90 are from Bayview Hunters Point.
I'm surprised that there's even 90 jobs out there.
Sol Bloom is executive director of ARC Ecology. It's an economic and environmental NGO for Bayview Hunters Point.
And these jobs are temporary jobs. They're not full-time jobs. They're not ongoing jobs that will last for years or for decades. These are temporary construction jobs.
The city controller actually has projections of what jobs will come into Bayview Hunters Point when the project is finished. There should be up to 12,000 permanent jobs across a range of incomes and occupations. More than two-thirds will be office jobs or R&D. Bloom says that's not a good fit for this community at this point.
The problem is that there's a whole bunch of people who live here right now who don't have those skills, won't have those skills and aren't trainable in many respects, given their age and their outlook, in those areas. And so are you creating the kinds of jobs that will help lift this community out of poverty? And our concern is you're not.
He says there's an alternative to building housing and office parks at the old shipyard. It's what happened in Philadelphia.
The Philadelphia Naval Shipyard closed 2 years after the San Francisco Naval Shipyard. And what they did was they found a large Scandinavian shipbuilding firm. They leased the yard to the Scandinavian shipyard firm. Now they got too much work.
More than 11,000 people currently work at that former military property. As is projected in San Francisco, there are dozens of companies employing people in office and R&D work. But there is also industrial, people building tanker ships and working on maritime trades. Bloom thinks that decisions being made at the reimagined San Francisco shipyard suggest a much different solution.
So the way we lift the Bayview out of poverty is by replacing the population that we have here with other people.
Right now, though, it's all speculation. There is a lot of work left to do. Travis Black is working on a windy afternoon at the construction site where the first buildings are taking shape. He lives in Mariners Village, a housing project right next to the shipyard. He knows about the 50% local hire requirement, and he says he thinks that's being met. But then I ask him how many people from his community are working here.
Man, I'm not sure. None.
So
a little bit of them. A little bit.
So why do you say that they're keeping the 50% promise?
Well, I don't know. They're not. I don't know if they are or if they're not. But they're using me, so I know they're using one person.
It's no surprise that Black's unsure. It's hard to tell what numbers are actually being met, even after asking the parties involved with the project. Black says his neighbors look upon all this work skeptically. They know what the community needs, he says, and they're just hoping the final result provides it.
I think they like it, but only if you give jobs, man. That's all they want is some jobs. That's all they want. They ain't really want too much. They just want some jobs. They don't got nowhere to work around here.
The city insists the shipyard will provide opportunities for everyone, and that the numbers of local hires are going to increase over the next several years. Whether or not that happens, the more telling story may be who's employed there on a permanent basis. In San Francisco, I'm Daphne Mazziaracchi for Cross Currents.
Tomorrow, our series on the redevelopment of the Hunters Point shipyard continues. We'll consider the toxic legacy the Navy left on the San Francisco waterfront.
We've had 2 decades of ongoing cleanup, and as a consequence, the shipyard's impact on the health of the Bayview neighborhood should have reduced significantly over that time. And yet we're finding these complaints still continue and that the situation has not changed.
That's part of our week-long series on the redevelopment of the San Francisco shipyard. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Last week in North Carolina, First Lady Michelle Obama spoke at a memorial service for poet Maya Angelou.
She showed us that eventually, if we stay true to who we are, then the world would embrace us. And she did this not just for black women, but for all women, for all human beings. She taught us all that it is okay to be your regular old self, whatever that is, your poor self, your broken self, your brilliant, bold, phenomenal self.
Her speech was a reminder of the struggles that many women have faced in order to achieve their goals. It was also a reminder that not too long ago, this country was a very different place, especially for women. Education has always played a key role in social change, but it hasn't always been equally available to both men and women. In the late 1800s, less than 1% of college-age women accessed higher education. But a small group of that elite crowd created what became known as the American Association of University Women, or the AAUW. The San Francisco chapter is the oldest branch in California and the third oldest in the country. Here to tell us more about this group's history and the role it played for women in California is former AAUW director Kathleen Cha.
It started in 1881 at two people's living room, and they invited 16 women who didn't know each other, and their commonality was they were unique. They were graduates of universities and actually going into higher education as well. When they got together, they realized what were the needs, what was important about this, and it was not just that they had education, but they needed to make sure others had access. And then the question that began to bubble then was, what was their responsibility? They had an education, what did it mean? From that early beginning, you had 16, within a year you had 60, and then even more. And out of that first group was one young woman called Sarah Dix Hamlin. And she had incredible degrees, of not only overseas, but here. And as they were discussing what we would do next, they began to realize it's not just this group. We need to have different chapters or branches, as we call them. And so she was on her way west to San Francisco, and they asked her to take on that and begin to set up. And so she came to San Francisco very shortly, had 8, 16, 32, not even within a year, to show you the talent and leadership that was there ready to, in a sense, take San Francisco by a storm.
And how was a university-educated woman perceived in that time?
In that time, besides anomaly, most of them were in classes where they never saw another woman. What was going on out of Harvard, a number of professors were saying, you know, higher education is injurious to women. It will give them brain fever, make them unable to have children, and other weaknesses. And so one of our early members, this Dr. Anne Howe, and there's a picture of her, and she looks like just this sweet little old lady. She is not. I think we've said she's kind of like a pit bull. She worked with the Massachusetts Bureau of Statistics and Labor, created the first study, and very conclusively proved that education did not injure women and showed the benefits of. Now, doesn't sound like much, but it had waves like you could not believe throughout, and really put to end what the professor, who was a leading scholar at the time, education scholar, and kind of, as we say, made him a little more red-faced about what he was doing. And so there was a lot of trepidation around women with university degrees. What were they going to do, and what was their value? And remember that we're talking about women that didn't even have the right to vote yet and what they were doing. And many of these, the women I talked about in San Francisco or that I've referred to in San Francisco, were all behind that early time that California in 1911 got the right to vote.
And what kind of priorities did they have? What were they advocating for?
So they got together like the other group and they took a look around at their community. And San Francisco at that time had a lot of issues. The whole issues of they saw the issues of maternal care, infant mortality. They saw the issues of education, what was going on in the schools, even access for girls into regular schools, much less college degrees. They really were about social justice and equity, and they began to define them, the whole issue of baby's milk or pediatric care. They set up the first settlement house. They went on to do some of the first studies in housing. They worked with the housing group at that time. They set up the first playground in San Francisco. It's kind of like a laundry list of first things. They were not ones to say, oh, we have problems. They went out and found solutions because they had early doctors, early teachers, as well as lawyers and what have you. They were catalysts for change.
That's Kathleen Cha. She is a leader of the American Association of University Women, and she just completed 6 years as director of the National Board. And we're talking about women in higher education more than 100 years ago, back when the American Association of University Women was created in 1881. One of these women, these early pioneers of the American Association of University Women, created the Hamlin School for Girls.
Yes.
Which we'll hear about in another piece later on in the show. And one became president of Mills College over in Oakland.
Yes, we're talking about Dr. Aurelia Henry Reinhart, who was an early leader for the San Francisco branch. But at the same time, she was Mills College president. But she went on, because of her leadership for AAUW in 1921, is when we brought together all of these other collegiate alumni groups and whatever. We'd all been operating in many different ways, brought them together under one umbrella, the AAUW, American Association of University Women.
So today, women make up the majority on college campuses. How do you see that fact in the light of this history of activism, and what is the value of the American Association of University Women today?
Well, you have to remember, we've always had a twofold kind of mission. It's not just that we are looking to get for women total full access, although access right now is still very, very difficult. You say many women are there, but then you ask, so they graduate, are they graduating to equal pay? Are they graduating to fair pay? Are they graduating to work conditions that will, you know, in a sense, make the best workforce possible? Equal pay, the harassment are all still critical issues. We're not only about access to education and quality of education for women and girls, but also you have a responsibility. All right, you have that education. How are you serving your community? What are you doing in your community to make it a better place to
live? And that really seems to get at these progressive roots that you're talking about, the history, this deep sort of social justice legacy.
We have as our tagline, empowering women since 1881. And that is what it's all about. It's making sure that women and girls have an understanding of their full range of choices and being able to develop their skills in the best way, not only for the community, for their family, and in the workplace.
Kathleen Cha is the former director-at-large of the American Association of University Women. To learn more about the organization, go to kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. As we just heard, one of the pioneers of women's rights in California was Sarah Dix Hamlin. Decades before women had the right to vote in the United States, Hamlin purchased and became director of a school for girls in San Francisco's Pacific Heights neighborhood. It became known as the Hamlin School, designed to educate girls to meet the challenges of their time. KALW's Angela Johnston takes us on a tour of the 150-year-old school to find out how they're fulfilling that mission today.
So you're making a shape, and would that be in the printer?
Yeah, so you would build like a square like this, and then you can use this up tool and like move it up.
And so, Callie Jones is showing me how to 3D print a tiny yellow chess piece. She designed it herself on a computer. It's her second day in the 3D printing club, and she's already a pro.
And so it just starts to build up and up and up until you make the figure that it's printing.
Jo Jones is a sixth grader at the Hamlin School, one of the oldest K-8 girls' schools in San Francisco. But you can almost forget that history, given the high-tech toys these girls get to play with.
It's just so cool to see how far technology has come from just like a little paper printer.
This tiny 3D printer tucked away behind wooden doors in this ornate historical mansion symbolizes how this 150-year-old girls' school has transformed over the past two centuries. It has managed to embrace the future while keeping with tradition.
So upstairs, we have classrooms mostly for 7th and 8th grade.
Lisa Aquino is Hamlin's admissions officer.
I'm also a graduate, class of 1981. Also a parent of an alum who graduated last year. Also, two siblings came through with me.
She gives me a tour of the school's three buildings. We peek into biology labs, rooftop courts with stunning views of the bay, dance studios, and old living rooms that now house books and desks. The school has kept many of the mansion's original 19th century Edwardian touches. High ceilings with wood moldings, chandeliers, and dozens of staircases.
Of course, we have elevators as well. But our girls have very strong hearts and strong legs.
We continue up the stairs to meet Wanda Holland Green, the head of school.
A lot of people associate the Hamlin School of today with this building on Broadway, one of the beautiful flood mansions, when in fact Hamlin is a key concept in many ways as much as it is a school.
A concept and core philosophy that Holland Green says has remained the same since the 1890s, even though the school itself has changed over the years. The philosophy can be traced back to the school's founder, Sarah Dix Hamlin.
She was an audacious woman. She was one of the first women to attend the University of Michigan. And she could be found, even as a young girl, debating political issues of the time with men, thinking about women's rights and our place in the world.
After traveling and teaching around the world, Sarah Dix Hamlin moved to the West Coast.
And she decided that she would set up her school here in California. And she acquired the Van Ness Seminary, which dates back to 1863. And she says, you know what? I will establish a place for girls and women to be educated to meet the challenges of their time.
The school has since moved buildings, and the challenges have also changed. For example, today only 1 in 7 engineers are female, and women hold less than a third of computer science jobs. So Hamlin has a huge focus on science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM. It recently added the 3D printing club, robotics in second grade, and coding class in fifth grade.
Our youngest girls at Hamlin walk into their science classroom and they put on a lab coat because they need to imagine themselves as a doctor and as a person who can program robots.
But these opportunities come at a cost. Hamlin's tuition is almost $30,000 a year. That's almost three times as much as California spends per student per year in the public school system. Holland Green acknowledges that this is a huge challenge for Hamlin in terms of access and diversity.
By definition, a tuition-charging school is going to slice a certain part of the population and become exclusive. So the question is, how do you embrace that reality and then work very hard to make sure that you don't also become self-absorbed and separate from the world in which you reside?
So over the past 6 years as head of school, Holland Green increased outreach and scholarships to low-income students.
Well over 40% of the students at Hamlin are not white. Almost half of the new kindergarten class are girls of color.
Holland Green says what keeps her hopeful is the school's ability to stay true to Sarah Dix Hamlin's vision. One morning, I joined the students on a school-wide field trip to a nearby park. Through games, they learn about water molecules, drought-resistant plants, and how they can conserve water at home. During a break, fourth grader Virginia Bonney tells me what she loves about her school.
We just learn so much, and it's all in a fun way. Like, we have activities where we learn even when we don't really notice it.
Learning without even noticing it. A sign of progress for girls' education, and something the Hamline School will strive to bring to girls for the next 150 years. In San Francisco, for Cross Currents, I'm Angela Johnston.
You can find more information about the Hamline School and ongoing education coverage by visiting our website, we're KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Isabel Angel, Jeremy Dalmas, Audrey Dilling, Sandia Dirks, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Ryan Miller, Stephen Short, Julia Scott, and Melanie Young. Today's show was engineered by Mr. Seth Samuel. Our line producer is Leela Day. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Congratulations to Martina and the team for winning an Edward R. Murrow today. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And because of your support, we can proudly say that we are listener-supported local public radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.